Welcome to the Composer Studio Podcast. On the Composer Studio, we listen to the music of living composers. We talk to them about their writing process, and we learn about the world of music that they live and work in.
Welcome back. We're back from winter vacation, and we are ready to start a great new season. I'm Anna Linville.
And I'm Tarek Ghirardella. And today our guest is composer Peter Askim. Peter is active as a composer, but also as a conductor and a bassist. He is the artistic director of the Next Festival of Emerging Artists and the conductor of the Raleigh Civic Symphony and Chamber Orchestra, as well as the director of the orchestra activities at North Carolina State University. Peter has also held positions as music director and composer in residence of the Idlewild Arts Academy Orchestra and faculty of the University of Hawaii, Manoa, where he directed the Contemporary Music Ensemble. Peter is a dedicated champion of the music of our time, and in addition to composing, he has conducted many new works by many composers, including several who have been on our show this past season. Peter, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, sorry it took so long to set this up. It's been a time.
A lot's changed for you in the last 6 months. You had the birth of a baby and you've expanded your family. And, you know, I wanted to ask if I don't know if you've been composing any music in that amount of time, but has this at all affected the way that you are writing music, or do you think it's going to affect the way you write music?
You know, that's interesting. I have been writing music. I, you know, like everybody else, I had, you know, five projects that got canceled from day to day. But I do have a consortium commission that I've been working on. And luckily, I'd done a lot of that kind of front end work of generating material. So when I write, I generate a lot of material. And most of my process is getting rid of the stuff that's no good. Most of the time, now I've been able to just be part of the editing process and getting rid of all of the stuff that needs to be gotten rid of. And so I have been able to do that. It's just squeezing it into little chunks is a different way of thinking. You know, I'm used to having a whole weekend to just kind of marinate in something. And now I have to kind of attack a little bit of it at a time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe it'll make me a little bit more efficient. Maybe I can get rid of the bad stuff quicker.
Mm-hmm. You have to figure out how to induce flow state a little bit faster.
That's right. Yeah. I'm not relaxing fast enough.
Get on it.
That's right.
Well, I'm sure you're going to be a really great father because, you know, you have such a passion for young people and teaching. And, you know, from what I've read about your students are very enthusiastic about what you do. And I know you're passionate about them. Do you want to speak to that just a little bit? Tell us about the Next Festival and how your mentorship, your philosophy on mentoring young people, young composers?
Sure. So I started the Next Festival of Emerging Artists 9 years ago, and I started it to be kind of the anti-festival, to really help students in a way that I felt was missing from most other festivals. So this is a place where I try and give them all of the different pieces of the puzzle about what it's like to be an artist now, you know, so the artistic part, but also kind of entrepreneurial thinking about how to create in changing times and, you know, what they call portfolio careers, all kinds of the different pieces of the puzzle that I felt were kind of missing for me. And I had to make up as I went along. But it stems from a real passion for young people and, you know, in the cheesiest way possible, you know, pay it forward. I had really generous teachers growing up, and I feel like I can't do that much for them, but I can help, you know, the next generation to kind of realize their goals in a way. And that's incredibly fulfilling for me. I'm super inspired by working with young people who are super serious and really trying to do this in the most intense and way possible and with lots of integrity and lots of passion, and it keeps me energized. And the festival is focused on new music. It's focused on string players and composers and choreographers in their 20s, so at the beginning of their careers, and creating new ways of making music and kind of decoding how to play contemporary music and how to, as a composer, how to talk about your work with players and notate it in a way that is clear and gives you the result in your mind. So mm-hmm. I'm a performer, I'm a composer, you know, and I feel like bridging that gap is really one of my great passions.
Mm-hmm. You play the bass. Some call it the contrabass or the double bass. Was it a teacher that got you interested in playing that instrument?
It wasn't. You know, I had started out playing piano when I was younger, and I got the recognition. I'm officially the world's worst clarinetist.
So, did they give you a plaque?
I have a plaque.
Oh, go ahead.
I have a plaque. Yep. But, you know, when I became a teenager, I started really being passionate about the bass, you know, and it kind of came from rock and roll players and jazz players, and also just the bass lines of Bach. The things that were there and supporting and melodic that kind of undergirded everything and kind of were the structure and the context for everything that everybody thought was interesting, but that's actually the interesting part. Mm-hmm. So I started playing electric bass and played a little bit of every music. I was in a country band for a day and a speed metal band for a day.
you quickly decided those weren't for you.
Or they decided I wasn't for them.
Yeah.
No. It was mutually agreeable. But I do, you know, I have a lot of musical interests actually, and kind of trying to play different kinds of music. I think it was important. And then, you know, I finally got a double bass or string bass, whatever people like to call it, and figured out that actually it's super, super hard. So I'll do that.
We're going to go ahead and listen to a piece of yours called Edge that was written for solo bass. You would compose it and performed it. And the performance we're going to hear is you playing the instrument. And then when we come back, we can go ahead and talk a little bit more about the piece.
Thank you.
That was Edge for solo bass performed by the composer. Peter, that is such a lyrical piece. And I have a hunch that most listeners aren't aware that the bass can be such an expressive instrument, a huge range that you've explored in that piece. And I was wondering, what are your thoughts on the amount of music that is written for solo bass and how solo bass is used in ensemble pieces?
Sure. So historically, there was actually a lot of music written for solo bass in the classical period. There's a whole tradition of Viennese concertos. And then it sort of was a big, vast wasteland with a couple, you know, star musicians like Bottazzini and Koussevitzky. So there isn't a lot of great solo repertoire for the bass, or there hasn't been, but let me say that that's rapidly changing. And from the kind of 60s forward, there's been a big focus on bass as a solo instrument. And, you know, it's interesting the evolution of the technique and the musicality and the playing level has just totally revolutionized right alongside and contributing back and forth with the solo repertoire that's being written for the instrument. So it's actually a really exciting time. There's a lot of people who are writing for bass and a lot of people who are writing better for bass. And interestingly, this piece was written for a competition. So there's the International Society of Double Bassists, the International Society of Bassists had a solo competition, and this was the required piece that each one of the competitors had to play. They could play their other repertoire, but then play this one. And it was really interesting to see, number one, you know, how 12 different musicians interpreted this at the time, but also to see just over the last, let's say, 15 years, when it was written, it was really pushing the envelope. Mm-hmm. You know, people played it well, but nobody really nailed it. And now, you know, high school kids are really ripping it up with this. So just what's happening now with the instrument is really interesting. And I think for composers in general, it's a big untapped resource. It's a little gnarly to write for, you know, things that kind of seem intuitive are a little difficult. You know, for instance, you can't play more than a whole step without having to shift, which is, you know, kind of an inconvenience. But once you figure out those things that are idiomatic and the little tricks, there is a huge range that can be exploited in a lot of different colors. And of course, you know, lots of traditions that the bass comes from, including jazz and rock and in addition to classical.
Yeah, there's so much to draw from now. And I wonder, you know, you're talking about the improvement in the abilities of interpreters and players. Do you wonder if there's maybe some kind of solidification of the vernacular, the musical vernacular now around some of these, you know, some of the jazz influences and people? I think maybe early on, in the 50s and 60s, new music was really hard. You know, it was designed to be hard and strange, and it was hard to get a feeling for it. But it seems to me that there's some kind of coalescence around a musical vernacular. There's understanding among the young, the younger players, and they feel this music now. They get it, you know?
I think that the younger generation of players, and I don't know whether it's the internet or whether they're just smarter than we are.
Probably that.
Or both. But there's a lot more awareness of different styles of music. And, you know, there are a lot of modernist techniques in general in composition that have sort of been absorbed into the bloodstream of music, but also, you know, groove, right? And kind of post-minimal things and jazz and rock and even speed metal and country. And I think I think you're right. I think that there's a kind of broader scope of awareness, and the music itself probably has moved more towards the vernacular, and players are just really phenomenal these days.
You talked about your respect for Bach and then early, you know, when we were talking about the repertoire for the bass, about Mozart in the classical period, how there was so much repertoire. Why did you decide to become a composer and not an interpreter of those great pieces?
You know, that's interesting. I mean, I started out being an interpreter of those pieces, and my day job was playing in a symphony orchestra, right? So I was a professional bassist for quite a while. And in the end, I found a couple things. You know, there's a whole tradition of very flashy classical period-based music, and Bottazzini, for instance, is a contemporary of Verdi and wrote very virtuosic bass music. And there was always going to be somebody who played that better than I did. You know, it was great, but I wasn't going to, you know, distinguish myself or make a living, or, and it wasn't really speaking to me. But since the beginning of music, I was always had a compositional aspect to me. You know, I was, whatever that was, I was writing songs when I was younger and just kind of improvising things. And so there hasn't been a big distinction between playing and interpreting and creating. So it just felt natural to me. And I think there's actually quite a few bass player composers, just like there's quite a few bass player conductors. And I think maybe you just get bored.
Well, so you have like you said, you're very grounded in the structure when you're a bass player. So it makes sense. You understand right. that part. And so it's right. an easy jump. Well, the next piece we're going to listen to is A Late Winter, Early Spring. And this was inspired by a poem by Elizabeth Bishop. Do you want to just give us a little bit of an intro on the poem, and then we'll come back and talk about it afterward?
Sure. So Elizabeth Bishop has, you know, been an amazing influence of mine, or I've been a fan of her poetry. And there's something about this poem and the piece. It's just this feeling of winter that's not quite letting go. But there's already the feeling of rejuvenation, you know, so this kind of interstitial period where things are still frozen and kind of crusted over, but moving on the inside. And that's just what this piece has kind of in its DNA to me.
This is A Late Winter and Early Spring by Peter Askim, performed by the Cantus Ensemble Zagreb, Croatia, with Ivan Josip Skender conducting.
Thank you.
That was A Late Winter and Early Spring by composer Peter Askim. It was performed by the Cantus Ensemble Zagreb, Croatia, Ivan Josip Skender conducting. You know, that piece is so emotional, and it's connected to this poem that seems to go through a lot of different ups and downs. And how does your emotional world and orientation affect you as a composer as you write?
You know, that's an interesting question, just specifically about this piece, and I guess maybe even more in general. I always feel like the great composers are really psychologists, and have just the way that one emotion becomes another through time and all of the different gradations of it, you know, how things ebb and flow, and the messiness and ambiguity and dead ends and accumulations that happen, is something that really fascinates me in other music, and something that I go for in my own music too. You know, I mean, you know, it's almost a cliche, but, you know, Mahler said that basically music is the things that happen beyond words. And I think that that's really true. And I think in this piece in particular, that was something that I was going for, is those subtle shifts that happen, kind of almost a kind of emotional seismograph. That was really interesting to me to sort of trace that. And you know, it was written for a sinfonietta, right? So one on a part, kind of an orchestra of soloists. And the little strands and threads and the interweavings and how one sound becomes another sound and one line kind of caresses or diverges from other ones was really interesting to me to explore. And you know, the images that we were talking about a late winter where it's still, you know, threatening frost and everything, the earth is coming alive, that kind of dichotomy and where the barriers and the boundaries are not clear, super fascinating to me and mm-hmm. and something that I was really trying to trace with this piece in a very intuitive and yet brave way, mm-hmm. to kind of distill it down to the essence of that shifting mental and psychological emotional states.
Do you allow yourself to explore emotions that you don't express normally yourself? Because your personality outwardly is very gregarious and fun and jokey. But sometimes I sense a little bit of, you know, there's some darker things in there that it seems like you're exploring. You know, so when Tarek asks about your emotional orientation, how does music open you up or allow you to deal with some of your own personal emotions and feelings?
Oh, I don't have any.
Like you.
I'm just a fun guy to get a beer with. I think that, you know, music has always been for me that way to kind of plumb the things that don't always rise to the surface. And Robert Motherwell, the abstract expressionist painter, always said that you know, he didn't really know what he was feeling until he painted it. And I think music has always been a way for me to access those other places, which, you know, you don't bring up when you're out for a beer. Mm-hmm. And that's what's always been, you know, special, I think, about music is that very inner world to cultivate and explore. But I'm also hilarious, so there is that.
Peter, what are your musical habits of seeing and hearing the world around you? Do you just let it come to you, or are you out there actively listening?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And you know, the kind of boundaries between the arts for me have always been sort of permeable. And I've always felt a real kinship with poetry and the visual arts and also with nature too, almost as much as, you know, other musics. You know, I have really heavy influences and you know, as a conductor, I have other people's music in my head all the time. But I think part of it is a process of trying to get that out and react to something, whether it's something internal or whether it's natural beauty or it's always interesting to get inspiration from poetry. It gives you a whole different framework and it's almost collaborative, even though, you know, Elizabeth Bishop and I were never alive at the same time, even so. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
It does, yeah. You know. I'm sure that that question has many answers and you could write a book about it. But the next piece I want to talk about actually goes more into some of your emotional it there's a lot of emotion in it, but it's also, you know, trying to evoke a specific image almost. But this one, Our Passage to the Stars, is really, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in your notes, you say it's an emotional journey that encompasses great intensity and intense fragility, but is always fundamentally deeply human. And I thought that was a really interesting thing to write in the program notes. And I think you do a good job of demonstrating that in your music. So I'd love for us to give that a listen. This is Our Passage to the Stars by Peter Askim with Olga Klyonkina, piano. Thank you. That was Our Passage to the Stars by Peter Askim with Olga Klyankina piano. We were talking about mood a little bit. Do you have any, I know this is a kind of a one of those topics that has no answer, but do you have any personal theories about why that is?
I don't. That's an interesting question. I mean, the only thing I can think of is somehow, you know, it's, we hear something that resonates with our own experience and our own, you know, frequencies somehow. That's something that it just resonates somehow with our own inner makeup. That's a really interesting, tough question. I mean, I know from the creator side of things, I'm really interested in not especially inducing mood, but communicating the variance in emotional state. And, you know, this piece in particular really kind of runs the gamut of that. It is really a journey from questioning maybe to, I don't even want to put a name on it and back. But I think what I really aspire to do is be fundamentally honest through music and all of the ambiguity and negotiate in real time this honest trajectory of emotion and not wrapping things up in bows and more questions than answers, maybe. Mm-hmm.
I want to transition to our last piece, As Glaciers Thaw. It's an interesting piece to me for a few reasons. One of the reasons is the orchestration. And I noticed right off the bat it was for strings. And, you know, it seemed to be mimicking the cold feeling and the icy feeling, you know, when I think about As Glaciers Thaw. Immediately what came to mind was Bernard Herrmann. When he, you know, the score for Psycho that he composed. And, you know, he specifically chose strings because he didn't want to give it much color. It was a black and white film at the time of color films. And he wanted to stay really neutral with the sound, but he also felt that it added to the thrilling quality of the film. And I wanted to ask you, what made you decide that strings only was a great orchestration choice for this piece?
Well, that's an interesting question that, I mean, I can answer it in two ways. The most practical is that it was written for a string group, and that was the ensemble that I was writing for at the time. So it's kind of cart and horse, I guess. But in this piece in particular, you know, you're talking about the coldness. I find with strings, you know, it does have this whole range of color. You know, when you're using harmonics or, you know, non-vibrato or things with faster bow speeds, there is a kind of an icy coldness that you can get with string instruments, kind of a remote purity of sound that almost mimics crystallized snow or ice. But there is also, of course, you know, the incredibly warm sound of romantic vibrated big sound of strings, you know, so it's got that duality. And I think that's fascinating to me about strings. They can be incredibly emotional and incredibly icy and cold, and all of the gradations in between. And I think that's one of the things that this piece does. In the program notes, I talk about it begins very cold and then kind of comes alive, almost like the glacier is thawing, or, you know, the idea maybe of global warming. And it's depicted through the instruments. You know, they actually come alive. You know, you could almost say in the score, you know, play more warmly here. And then it trails off, kind of refreezing at the end. Like I said, it's cart before the horse. I was writing for strings, but the strings were the perfect vehicle to create this sound world of both pure cold and intense warmth.
You know, it's interesting when you just brought a question to mind, your comment about how you notate a feeling, you know, convey a feeling or an instruction to a player to convey some kind of warmth. How do you, in your score, we don't have the score in front of us, but how did you convey these different qualities and the different contrasts to the player?
You know, that's a really interesting question. And I think I'm a performer, I'm a conductor, and I'm a real believer in being clear about notation and, you know, putting notes on the page is for me always just the very beginning. That doesn't even begin to crack the surface of what the music is really about. It's like if you just kind of did a dry reading of Shakespeare as if you were reading the phone book. Yeah, sure, all the things are there, but it's not what he meant in any way. So I tend to be quite imagistic, I guess, in my notations in the score, and, you know, so maybe writing something like crystalline and pure, or, you know, awakening, or with great urgency, and, you know, try and evoke something which is beyond just the notes and the rhythms that gets to what I think is really there in the music, you know, that bridge that gap between notation, which I find to be necessary, but evil. Mm-hmm. And you know, what I really feel is happening underneath the surface of the music. So I notate very heavily and in words as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you ever use the old words like allegro and lento and all the old Italian words?
No. No, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I thinking about it, I don't really. First of all, allegro means nothing now, mm-hmm. because it, mm-hmm. Because it can mean so many things, right? If it means mm-hmm. everything, it means nothing anymore. I also think that it doesn't get to the subtlety of the color or the intense emotion that I'm going for. And that, you know, when I'm conducting, I try and find in each piece of music too. I think it's there. It's more imagistic and poetic and evocative, I think, that the type of words that I use in the score to kind of augment what's already in the music.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. It has been an absolute pleasure having you with us and being able to share your music with the listeners.
It's been really fantastic. And, you know, I love the show, and I love being able to think about things in broader terms, and specifically too, like the both of you do. So thanks for all the great thoughts and insights and questions. And I could do this all day. Thanks for having me.
We could too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We are going to listen now to As Glaciers Thaw by Peter Askim, Tokyo Symphony, Naoto Otomo conductor, commissioned by the Lolani Concert Orchestra and premiered in Honolulu in December 1999.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the music of Peter Askim on the Composer Studio. We hope you've enjoyed the show.
We want to hear from you. Have you discovered new music that moves you? Share it with us. Are you a composer who would like to be featured on the show? Get in touch. Just want to tell us what a great job we're doing? Tweet us. Leave us a comment on our Facebook page or Instagram. Even send us an email. And if you have a minute, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts.
And before we say goodbye, we want to send you off with a little something that really struck home with us this week. As the composer John Cage once wisely observed, we need not destroy the past. It is gone. Thanks for listening, everybody. Until next week.